This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote. Drug maker Johnson & Johnson is seeking approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to authorize its single-dose COVID-19 vaccine for emergency use. The company's application follows its January 29th report, in which it said the vaccine had a 66% rate of preventing infections in its large global trial. Unlike the two currently authorized vaccines from Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna, Johnson & Johnson's does not require a second shot or need to be shipped frozen. The single-shot vaccine could help boost supply and simplify the U.S. immunization campaign amid concerns due to the more contagious U.K. coronavirus variant and the potential of lower vaccine effectiveness against a variant that first emerged in South Africa. President Joe Biden promised Thursday that the United States will sharply increase its engagement around the world during his White House tenure, ending what he contended was 4 years of neglect and abuse of foreign relations by former President Donald Trump. Biden declared at the State Department in his first major foreign policy address, "As president, America cannot afford to be absent on the world stage," adding diplomacy is at the center of the foreign policy. He said that American alliances are our greatest assets, while warning both Russia and China of American resolve. Trump, employing an American first credo, had often quarreled with traditional U.S. allies while taking a softer tone with authoritarian states. Biden said he told Russian President Vladimir Putin in a phone call, "The days of U.S. rolling over to Moscow are over." By a remote, this is VOA News. A fiercely divided U.S. House of Representatives tossed Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene off both her committees on Thursday, an unprecedented punishment that Democrats said she'd earned by spreading hateful and violent conspiracy theories. Mostly all Republicans voted against the Democratic move, but none defended her lengthy history of outrageous social media posts. The vote forced Greene's Republican colleagues to go on the record to defend or rebuke her after she has drawn bipartisan condemnation over her past remarks. The political drama for Republicans underscores the tension that has risen since Donald Trump lost the White House. As the House Republicans caucus reached an easy agreement Wednesday to spare Greene of punishment, it also turned back an effort to remove Liz Cheney from her position as the third highest-ranking Republican in the House over her January vote to impeach Trump on a charge of inciting insurrection. An advisor to former President Trump said he rejected a request by House Democrats to testify under oath at his upcoming impeachment trial, claiming the proceedings is unconstitutional. Lead impeachment manager Jamie Raskin asked in a letter sent by email Thursday that the former president testify either before or during the trial that begins next Tuesday. Trump is charged with inciting a mob of supporters that broke into the U.S. Capitol on January the 6th. But just before the attack, which results in the deaths of five people, Trump told thousands of supporters at a rally near the White House to fight like hell as Congress was in the process of formally certifying President Joe Biden's election win. A Capitol police officer was among those who died in the rioting, and the House impeached Trump 1 week later with the help of 10 Republicans who joined Democrats in support. Myanmar's military government blocked public access to Facebook Thursday amid growing popular resistance to this week's overthrow of the country's civilian government. Ministry of Communications and Information issued a statement saying the social media giant would be blocked until Sunday in order to keep stability in the country. The U.S.-based company urged Myanmar's military leaders to restore connectivity in order to ensure citizens can communicate with family and friends and access important information. Myanmar's military, the Tat Mada, seized power Monday, declaring a year-long state of emergency and detaining de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. For more news, please join us, voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown via remote, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, February 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandans react to the guilty verdict of LRA's Dominic Ongwen.
The judge signaled that no matter how long it takes, justice will always remain if evidence is properly collected and presented to courts of law.
President Museveni announces new academic year and schools reopening. Africa's second COVID-19 wave sees higher death rates and vaccine delays. Tomorrow, Saturday, is the International Zero Tolerance Day for FGM. We'll have a report from Kenya, and a Burundi Supreme Court ruling against alleged coup plotters is revealed.
Those people who have been condemned, most of them are the ones who are trying to tell the government to stop imprisoning people. Those are the civil society activists and independent media personnel, including also some guys from the army who made the coup attempt.
And remembering a Guinea-Bissau activist who died last week. Those stories plus Samson Omale Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandan victims of the Lord's Resistance Army, the LRA, have welcomed the war crimes conviction of the militant group's second-in-command. The International Criminal Court in The Hague has found LRA child soldier-turned-commander Dominic Ongwen guilty on 61 charges, ranging from murder and rape to kidnapping and torture. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
Among the charges Dominic Ongwen was convicted of Wednesday is the crime of conscripting children under the age of 15 into the LRA's senior brigade and using them to participate in hostilities. Oyette Vincent was 12 years old, living in the Lukodi displaced persons camp in northern Uganda when Lord's Resistance Army rebels launched a war against Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni in 1987. Vincent says he and other children were abducted a total of six times and forced to fight in the war. Vincent says he feels overwhelmed today, but adds he feels lucky to witness the verdict.
You know, it has taken long. We've been waiting for it. I feel that it is almost at the doorstep, only that I'm now waiting for the sentence. It will also bring attention to other people that irrespective of the color, whether they are sort of big, we are all equal before the law.
Ongwen was found guilty on 61 of 70 counts of crimes against humanity and war crimes. The charges were for his role in attacks on four internally displaced people's camps in northern Uganda between July 2002 and December 2005. He was found guilty on charges of murder, kidnapping, torture, enslavement, rape, sexual slavery, and forced marriage, among many others. Brian Kalenge, an international war crimes lawyer working with the ICC office in Uganda, says it was important that justice prevailed.
I think this is a big step in terms of addressing psychologically the effects of that war. You know that we say there can be no peace without justice. So it was very important that Ongwen was found guilty so that we can then begin the process of reparations.
The government of Uganda lodged the case against Ongwen and other LRA leaders, including the group's supreme leader, Joseph Kony, in 2004. Uganda government spokesperson Ofwono Opondo says the verdict is a strong warning to all who want to take up arms, saying impunity will not be tolerated.
It sends a signal that no matter how long it takes, justice will always remain if evidence is properly collected and presented to courts of law. And we hope this ruling should send a signal to everybody in Uganda, particularly those who want to take the course that Ongwen and the Konis took.
Kony, who is wanted by the ICC on charges similar to Ongwen's, remains at large. He is believed to be in the Central African Republic, but has not been definitely cited in years. Ongwen now awaits sentencing for his crimes. He faces up to 30 years in prison. For victims like Oyette Vincent, they now await a reparation session. However, Vincent says no amount of money can replace the hundreds of thousands of lives lost and destroyed. Halima Othmani for VA News, Kampala.
Uganda continues to ease the lockdown measures put in place to curtail the spread of COVID-19 by allowing more learners to return to school. In a televised speech Thursday evening, President Yoweri Museveni said the country will also start the vaccination program against the disease. Mugumi Davis Rakariji has more from Kampala.
Speaking to the nation this Thursday evening, Mr. Museveni said the shutdown of schools in March last year saved lives of millions of students. In September last year, the government started to partially reopen schools with candidate students. Mr. Museveni said this helped schools to manage standard operating procedures such as maintaining social distance among learners.
Indeed, our reasoning was correct because the candidate class learners were apparently 1.3 million. Out of the population of 15 million. Now this less than 10% using the facilities that were previously being used by 15 million. Indeed, since we opened, it's now 3 months for the candidate classes. Up to now, only 257 have reported with corona, and nobody has died.
He said the government will continue systematically return students to school with others studying in shifts where possible, starting with next month.
Since this has worked, we have now decided to open for the, what they call the semi-candidate classes. This is the term they are using for the next candidate classes. These are S5, S3, and primary 6.
This, he said, makes up to 1.7 million students. He also said the government has also allowed the opening of universities and other tertiary institutions. Some educationists, however, have expressed concerns over some schools' lack of resources to implement measures aimed at preventing the spread of COVID-19. They also worry that some teachers have changed professions and may not be willing to return to classes. The government's online program has also faced criticism, with some areas lacking network coverage, radios, and television sets. Mr. Museveni said all learners will eventually return to school, and the academic year 2020 will end this July. He also announced plans for vaccination program that will start with essential workers and vulnerable people.
We are going to get 3.5 million vaccines from a program known as COVAX facility. This is a group of countries which got together and funded vaccines for developing countries. However, we are also arranging to buy directly from the Serum Institute of India 18 million doses.
Mr. Museveni said his government will continue to ease lockdown measures by opening up other sectors like bars and cinema halls. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
African health officials are expressing concern over a general rise in coronavirus cases, especially in southern Africa. They are also lamenting the delay in vaccine rollouts in those countries. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
As African nations wait for hundreds of millions of vaccine doses to arrive, health officials are concerned about a general rise in coronavirus death rates, especially in southern Africa. In the tiny kingdom of Eswatini, the global health organization Doctors Without Borders says health facilities are seeing 200 new cases per day and a death rate four times higher than they saw in the first wave. In the coastal nation of Mozambique, case numbers are nearly seven times higher than they were at the peak of the first wave last year. And in the landlocked nation of Malawi, new cases are doubling every 4 to 5 days, and the nation's main COVID facility is nearly full. Dr. John Nkengasong, head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says in about a third of the continent's countries, the death rate has risen above the global average.
It used to be the reverse. During the first wave, the case fatality rate was about 2.2%, and now we are seeing a 2.6%. In terms of the number of countries experiencing the second wave, 41 of them are currently experiencing the second wave on the continent. That is 41 of the 55 member states. Five countries that are accounting for about 70% of the caseloads.
Those five countries are South Africa, Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt, and Ethiopia. Africa escaped the worst of the pandemic for much of last year. Now health experts say that testing on the continent is lagging behind the rest of the world. They say vaccine rollout also has been slower, with just a handful of countries only recently launching vaccination campaigns. This, said Dr. Matsidiso Moeti, African Regional Director for the World Health Organization, is exactly what African health officials have been talking about when they warned against letting vaccine acquisition play out in the open market. A situation that gives wealthier nations advantages, like being able to negotiate for cheaper vaccines in larger quantities. Moeti, speaking to journalists Thursday, said she was still optimistic.
Clearly, global solidarity is still a work in progress. It was our ambition, it was our hope. It has not delivered to the extent that we had hoped, but it is still a work in progress. We are still doing our advocacy for donations from countries that have secured more vaccine to cover the entire population.
And, says Moeti, once African nations secure vaccine doses, they face another challenge, convincing people to take them. She emphasized that the vaccines approved by the WHO are safe and effective and says the organization is being proactive about dispelling the growing tide of false information about vaccines.
It is only lately that some of the anti-vaccine sentiments, messaging, initiatives and campaigns have started to land here. We need to build on African people's belief in vaccine for their children to help them to understand that something extraordinary was done to develop these vaccines. And of course, to be very factual about the fact that we are learning about the vaccines as we go along, but we know enough about their efficaciousness.
In summary, she said, if you can take a WHO-approved vaccine, do it. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, February 5th. Burundian President Evariste Ndayishimiye last week urged the country's National Communication Council to meet with independent media houses and journalists who have been under government sanctions and resolve any differences. A spokesperson said President Ndayishimiye was fulfilling his campaign slogan that if all Burundians come together, everything is possible. More than 100 independent media journalists fled Burundi during the administration of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Three media houses were accused of involvement in a 2015 alleged coup. Now, a Burundi Supreme Court ruling issued last June has been revealed. It is a life sentence for those accused of offenses against the state. It also prohibits them from exercising professional or social activity for 20 years and imposes monetary fines. A spokesperson told VOA that President Ndayishimiye's directive mentioned the Communication Council, not the court. Innocent Muhozi is the exiled director of the band TV Renaissance.
This is a very clear illustration of what's going on in Burundi. Those people who have been condemned, most of them are the ones who are trying to tell the government to stop killing people, to stop imprisoning people. Those are the civil society activists and independent media personnel, including also some guys from the army who made the coup attempt. But beyond this, this could mean two different things. The first one, the positive one, it could be that they publicize this judgment so that they condemn us, and it could be the first step that could lead to an amnesty if the president wants to make an amnesty about these people. The second possibility is that we know that there are heavy misunderstandings between two groups in the government. Some, the radical ones trying to keep the radical lines, and the ones trying to make some reforms, even superficial, but some reforms. So it could mean that some guys are pushing on the other direction while President Ndayishimiye is maybe trying to have some small reforms at least. So it could be one of these.
But Innocent, it was just last week that the government or the president, President Evariste Ndayishimiye, offered to at least be inclusive of the media in moving the country forward. Is this a setback now?
Okay, it could be a setback if there is no intention behind that decision to have the next step of amnesty. This could be really a negative step if you compare it to the step of last week.
Who are the, what media group organizations or individuals are affected by this court ruling?
At least four or five people. Renaissance, LPR, some guys who were at Isanganiro, Madame Anne, who was the director, Mr. Mitabaru, who was the newsroom chief, myself, and Bob Rugurika from LPR. So the same guys of the independent media who was, and Patrick Nduiman. All these guys who were the leaders of the independent media are in this list.
Is it possible, Innocent, that the court will do this, make this ruling without the government knowing about it?
It's so important that it's not impossible. Some guys in the government, at least they know about it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, James.
Innocent Muhoozi is the exiled director of TV Renaissance in Burundi. You're speaking with us from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Tomorrow, Saturday, is the International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation. The World Health Organization says more than 200 million girls and women have gone through FGM in 30 countries in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. The WHO says FGM that is performed on young girls between infancy and age 15 is a violation of the human rights of girls and women. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, one in five women and girls aged 15 and 49 in Kenya have undergone FGM, which the government has since termed an illegal practice.
As the world marks Zero Tolerance Day to FGM, Kenya has been a setback in its progress to eradicate female genital mutilation after some communities have been seen defying the government directives to end the practice. According to UNICEF, almost 9 in 10 cat women experience flesh removal, which is the most common type of FGM in Kenya. However, very few communities practice the most severe form of FGM, whereby the vaginal opening is staged. Sadia Hossein from the coastal region of Kenya underwent the cut at the age of 10 after pressure from her age mate, who told her she was incomplete in the society. However, the consequences that came with the cut at the time she was giving birth made her become an activist in the community, where she's facing resistance from her own people.
I started campaigning against FGM based on my personal experience. When I was giving birth to my first daughter, I went through complications because living in a society that believes in the values that are attached to FGM is really hard when you are not cut. So I had to now advocate and say this is bad. Some of the challenges I got, rejection from the survivors themselves.
A report by UNICEF states that Kenya's progress towards the eradication of FGM is stronger than that of other countries in Africa. Christine Alphonse's father was killed for protecting her not to undergo the cut. She says in her Kuria community in the southwest of Kenya, they circumcise both men and women according to the age, and the village elders have the power to kill those who refuse to undergo the cut, and her father became the victim for protecting her. She's now an activist to protect fellow girls after escaping the cut.
My dad, before he died, because he was killed trying to protect us, he took my brother to be circumcised in the hospital, but didn't want to take me because in our community it's a taboo for a younger sibling to be circumcised before the elder sibling. So my dad had committed two taboos, and the punishment therefore was to actually take me to be circumcised or cut, but my dad didn't want to do that. That's how my dad lost his life.
Traditional practitioners usually perform FGM in Kenya, as well as medical personnel who sometimes are responsible for the practice in specific communities. The chief executive officer and Anti-FGM Board of Kenya, Benedict Resian Lolojo, said that the government has embarked on FGM campaign that will see the most affected region stop the practice.
We have been doing very well in terms of creation of awareness, engaging our elders. So even as we continue engaging them, obviously we have those who don't agree with the fact that they need to end it. So one of the challenges we face is reaching out to all these communities.
Kenya outlawed FGM in the year 2011. The law stipulates a prison sentence of not less than 3 years or a fine of $2,000 for the crimes. A person who causes death of a girl through FGM can be sentenced to life imprisonment. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
A Guinea-Bissau activist died last week after authorities said there was no oxygen to treat him. Bernardo Cachura was a 39-year-old activist who produced music that addressed social justice issues. He also founded organizations to advance social causes such as lack of access to health care. Carlos De Silva is a spokesperson for Conscious and Informative Citizens Movement in Guinea-Bissau, also founded by Kachura. De Silva tells Ricky Stryer that Kachura died for the same things he was criticizing.
Mr. Bernadette Kachura passed away last Friday. According to the information that we got one day earlier, he was feeling stomachache while he was in the office. So the reason he had to abandon the office earlier. Later he went to the Simomindi Hospital, which is the major hospital we have in the country. And they told him there was no oxygen. So he got to go to the military hospital. And there, they told him that there's no medical available to perform that surgery. So he got to go to another private clinic in the Barrio Militao. When he got there, those people, they say, okay, they can perform the surgery. He himself is the one who take off his clothes, and he went to the operation room. But just after some minutes later, they said he passed away.
I know a lot of activists and people in the country have now spoken about the lack of oxygen in the hospital. What are some of the concerns of your group, given that this was the reason that was provided for Mr. Bernardo's death? And do you think this speaks about the health infrastructure, but also lack of access to what does exist within that infrastructure?
It's true that lack of oxygen can be one of the contributions to this death. But it's not the only one. We know that in our country, we have one of the worst health systems in the world. People just survive in hospital because of God's protection. But we have lack of everything, lack of medical assistance, lack of infrastructure, lack of equipment and everything. Without mention the strikes going on every time in the health public service.
That was Carlos De Silva, spokesperson for Conscious and Informative Citizens Movement in Guinea-Bissau. You're speaking with Ricky Stryer from Bissau. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the African Nations Championship, otherwise known as CHAN, holding in Cameroon as finalist for the tournament emerges after 3 weeks of competition. Title holders Morocco will play Mali at the Amadou Ahidjo Stadium in Yaoundé on Sunday. This comes after the two sides triumphed in the two semifinal matches played on Wednesday in the tournament exclusively designed for home-based players. The Eagles of Mali sealed their place in the final after winning 5-4 in a penalty shootout to eliminate their neighbors, Guinea. Morocco won their semifinal match in the late kickoff on Wednesday when they hammered host Cameroon 4-0 at the Limpe Stadium to book their place in the match in Yaoundé. Cameroonian fans were disappointed after the exit of the Indomitable Lions.
It was very, very good. It's just that the Indomitable Lions has failed us, but we don't mind because we believe that 2022 we are going to take the Nations Cup.
No offense, well, the match, due to my own point of view, it was disgracefully for the Cameroon Lions. So I don't think, if possible, the next time they should like put more effort. Yes, I'm disappointed. I'm really angry. Yes, I'm really angry.
The match is not okay. The Cameroonians, they have disappointed us. That's the problem. So let them try to succeed next time.
Very angry because very angry. This is not what we come to see.
Ahead of the Mali-Morocco final, some football fans have been predicting victory for the Atlas Lions of Morocco.
The Moroccans might prove too strong for them this time. I think they may not be able to cope with the high pressing style the Moroccans will get at.
I remember they won this competition in 2019, beating Nigeria in the finals, and they were not in doubt. You know, they were the best team in that competition. And even right now, they are still the best. And I believe they are going to beat the Eagles of Mali in the final.
Oluwaseun Oyedeji is the co-publisher of kick442.com. He's one of the several sports journalists covering the competition in Cameroon. I asked him for his thoughts on the reports that some players have been signing lucrative contracts with clubs abroad even before the end of the tournament.
I would like to commend CAF for coming up with this
competition is like a way of showcasing our local leagues. Even from this tournament, we've seen some players, after their country crashed out, they've joined lucrative jobs, they've moved on, like America have signed some have moved out of Africa and within Africa.
Guinea will play Cameroon in the third playoff at the Reunification Stadium in Douala on Saturday. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, February 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Barty, Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.